The story of westward expansion is really a fascinating chapter in our nation's history. And one chapter of that history that you may not be familiar with is the story of the people who moved west to settle what was called the Rain Belt. Larry Mueller here. David Wishart is a professor of geography at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he's the editor of the Encyclopedia of the Great Plains and Encyclopedia of the Great Plains Indians. He is also author of An Unspeakable Sadness, The Disposition of the Nebraska Indians. And most recently, the book we're going to be talking about today is titled The Last Days of the Rain Belt. And he joins us today from the studios of NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. David, thank you for joining us today. We got him there. Well, let's see. We do not have him. Let's see if we can get him. Let me try something else here. David, are you there? Not getting him. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm sure we will be able to get him on because I know our producer talked to him not long ago. So, we'll have him with us in just a minute. Let's see if we got him now. David, are you there? David, are you there? Well, nuts. We're just not getting him. There, now maybe we have him. David, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Ah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I can just hear you.
All right. Well, I'm really glad that we were able to get you. And thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I've had a lot of fun reading an interesting time reading your book. The question that came to my mind right away is, here we are, you're writing about a particular time in westward expansion, and wondering, well, why did you focus on this particular aspect of the larger story of westward expansion?
Well, I've done a lot of work on the dispossession of Native Americans, the other side of the frontier, if you want. And so I wanted to look at the American resettlement of the Great Plains. And really, it was that I chanced across a source that gave me the focus to the book. And that was these interviews that had been taken in the winter of 1933-34 by an organization, a New Deal organization called the Civil Works Administration. And they interviewed old-timers who had been the settlers in eastern Colorado, the Rain Belt, in the 1880s and then into the drought of the 1890s. So, I had the idea in mind of doing a book like this, but this really gave me the inside information.
Yeah, what a gold mine of information.
Yeah.
I'm telling you. Well, Rain Belt, when you talk about the Rain Belt, what parts of the American West are you referring to?
Well, really, eastern Colorado is the heart of it. The Rain Belt is, it's a time and a place and a delusion altogether. And the time and the place was the western High Plains, eastern Colorado, western Kansas, adjacent southwest Nebraska, settled rapidly in the 1880s and then depopulated just as rapidly in the 1890s. So that's the area, and the delusion was, of course, the settlers had been told that just by the very action of plowing over the earth and planting trees, they'd produce their own enhanced climate.
Amazing. Called the Rain Belt, really, not because of the precipitation, but because of what might be there, the potential.
That's right. It's not like the Corn Belt where you've got an excess. It was actually a deficit that they hoped to put right.
What was the basis for believing that human settlement could increase precipitation?
Just sheer willfulness in a way. You know, there weren't any solid rainfall records till about 1890, so you could make of climate what you wanted to make of it. And there were a lot of forces in society, the railroads who had land to get filled, the states who wanted people, they wanted the land productive. They all pushed it. And then, of course, you had university professors like me spinning this apocryphal story. So a lot of it was just what they wanted to see in the absence of no solid information of what was really the case.
You might take us back before the surge of settlement in a way. Who were the inhabitants before that area was opened up for an influx of settlers?
Well, the inhabitants, of course, were Plains Indians, mainly in that area, although it shifted, Comanches, Cheyenne, and Arapaho. And they sold their lands to the government in the 1860s and 1870s and were obliged, forced to go to Indian territory. By the time the Rainbelters, because that's what you call the settlers who came into the Rainbelt, by the time the Rainbelters got there, Native Americans were as scarce as the bison they had depended upon. Both were gone from that region. Very quickly.
Very quickly. And so the Rainbelt became a destination of new settlers. Exactly when was it? It was
Really in a rush, really, 1886, 87. Okay. And then, they came in. They were poor people. They were mainly from the Midwest. They had no other options in life. It was their last best chance, so they wanted to believe in it.
Yeah, and these new settlers, I think, as I recall from reading, they're primarily farmers, or maybe people with businesses who catered to farmers.
To a certain extent, these were people, young people, because elderly people didn't go to such a remote place, young people who couldn't afford to rent land or to buy land in Iowa or, in fact, East Ohio, where their parents probably were. And some were farmed, some had farm experience, some didn't, but nobody had experience of farming in an area that gets 12 to 15 inches of rain a year.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering, because there were ranchers or already using that land. You kind of wonder what their reaction was to all these people flooding in.
Well, their reaction wasn't good.
No.
Because these guys had it easy for 20 years. They didn't own land. They just occupied the range and put their cattle out there, cattle driven up from Texas, fattened on the range, taken in a year or two to the railhead towns, and these people made a lot of money. No overheads. Just leave them out all winter. Once the settlers got there, you start to get land fenced off, and the U.S. government favored settlers over ranchers because you could put a lot of more people in the area.
Yeah, yeah. And resulted later on in many a Western movie.
It did indeed.
Now that I think about it.
Yeah. Oh. It's a good theme, and it's based in reality.
Oh. Well, what incentives were... Well, before I get into that, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in, too. As you listen, is this a period of American frontier history that you know about? Did you have family members who went west in the 19th century with the hope of settling on productive lands, or just questions about the area? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Visiting today with David Wishart, who is a professor of geography at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and he is the author of The Last Days of the Rain Belt. Great to have him with us, and I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. And let's talk about incentives. What incentives were offered to people who were willing to take the risk?
Well, free and cheap land. By 1873, you could get 480 acres legally for $200. Through the homestead, you could get 160 acres free. Through the Timber Culture Act, lots of land laws. But even legally, it was a deal, 480 acres. But speculation was rife, you know, from petty speculation to large-scale speculation, chiseling the land laws, and so forth. So the federal government did have a big role in this. It in a sense, seduced people into the area with free and cheap land.
Yeah. And as you say, these new people, these new settlers came, primarily from the Midwest, including Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But they were not, they were not all experienced farmers.
No, not by any means. I don't have a complete breakdown of that, but it seems to me that many had little experience of farming, and as I say, certainly little experience of farming in the semi-arid area.
Yeah, and were they usually individuals, or were whole families making the move?
Both was the case. Quite often, a man would man would come out, leave his wife and children back in the old place while he established himself and then brought them out. Or quite often something like, you know, a man and a woman may intend to get married, but they wouldn't get married until they took out their, each took out their 160 acres, which was coming to them through the Homestead Act. And quite often what you had was not so much a, you know, a family migration as a family that reestablished itself in this new area over a period of time. Your brothers might come out, your sisters might come out, and then you've got a family there.
Yeah. And what role did the railroads play?
Well, they played a big role. For a start, nobody would have settled the area if those railroads weren't in place. There was no way to link the supplies or to market until you had railroads spanning those vast areas. And then the railroads, by virtue of getting land grants, generally 20 miles on either side of the railroad tracks, massive subsidy from the federal government, they wanted to sell those lands. So it was really in their interest to push this idea of the Rain Belt to get as many settlers as possible in their land grants.
That name is so, Rain Belt is so, what a misnomer.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, my goodness. Talking with David Wishart today about his book, The Last Days of the Rain Belt. You can join in, too, with your questions and comments. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and I hope you will join in with us. Any questions you might—did you have family members that got involved in this this adventure? I'm Larry Mealer. Marika Suval, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you'll stay tuned, because at 11:45 we'll enjoy our monthly visit with the weather guys. We'll talk about that polar vortex and how it's been covered by the media and a whole lot more. Right now, though, we're talking with David Wishart, author of The Last Days of the Rain Belt, inviting you to join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mealer Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And, David, I'm wondering if you can talk about the role of advertising and media and what role they played in selling the Rain Belt.
Yes, the advertisements were sometimes quite exaggerated. I remember seeing advertisements showing steamboats on the South Platte, you know, way out on the Western Plains. And the further away I think these embellished images landed, the more persuasive they were. There was a lot of false advertising, but mainly it was this idea, you know, you're going to create your own ameliorated climate and bring rain to an area that doesn't have it. That was the main advertising, that propaganda.
Yeah. The big surge of settlement in the Rain Belt, that was 86 through 90, I think, 1890.
That's right.
Tell us about those years. Can you talk about it?
Well, what had happened was in the mid-80s, this is typical of the Western Plains, you might have three or four good years, you know, of rainfall above average, followed by intensely arid years. And so in the mid-80s, there was some copious rainfall. The place looked green. It seemed to be complete vindication of the rain belt theory. So leading up to that rush was the fact that you had these good years, but also the fact that the land to the east had all been taken. So the last best opportunity was to come into this marginal area. So it was a specific context. 1890, then there was a drought. 1891, 92 were good rainfall years, and people who had quit in 1890 came back in.
Oh.
These people were willful optimists. And then there was a terrible drought from 93 to 96. Some places got no rain at all for entire years. And the people were just scorched off the land. There were locust infestations at the same time. And people were embittered. They left as embittered people who felt they'd been conned, essentially.
Yeah. And we saw, what was the increase in population during that kind of time period?
Well, you're talking thousands of people. It's a pretty sparsely populated area. Today it is. In fact, the maximum census year of population in this whole area was probably 1920, 1930, and it's been going down since. Yeah. So, yes, tens of thousands of people came in. Tens of thousands of people were busted in the mid-90s.
We will take some questions. If you'd like to join in, the number 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Let's turn to Marcus in Green Bay. Marcus, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, I find this expansion stuff really interesting, and then it reminds me of when they advertised for folks to sell everything and go up to Alaska and try to get going up there agriculturally and stuff. But then also, I was just wondering if the guest is familiar with here in Wisconsin, there's a person who up north somewhere, he started, he made all these little farmsteads and got people to go up there, and it eventually failed. But, you know, do you know what I'm talking about, Larry? Or
yeah, I'm not remembering the guy's name, but that was a sort of a private deal. Whereas this, what we're hearing today from David was actually a government-sponsored thing. But David, are you familiar with the perhaps not with the Wisconsin situation, but also the Alaska situation?
Just vaguely familiar with the ones that Marcus mentions, but it's all part of the same so-called frontier process in the United States. And that frontier process has been a boom and bust, you know, and not just in the Rain Belt, but elsewhere. And I suspect the Wisconsin settlers had the same opportunities of free and cheap land that the settlers in the Rain Belt had.
Yeah. This was, despite the number of people who came in, I was kind of interested in the sort of the social, to some extent, the social side of it, but also just the housing itself. I think, as you pointed out in the book or discovered through your work, the sod houses were kind of sort of the thing that people built, and a lot of people that hadn't. Probably no idea of how to put one together.
Yeah, it took some doing, but it was the immediate shelter. I don't think anybody wanted to stay in one longer than they had to. There was a connotation of poverty, of course, of living in the earth. They tried to make them hospitable. You know, as soon as an area was settled, not only did you have these sod houses and dugouts rising from the earth like mushrooms, but you had lime pits because people would make lime and they'd whitewash the, the walls inside, so to give an illusion you weren't living in the earth. Yeah. And you, if you had the money, you'd put a wooden floor in. They were efficient, thermally efficient buildings, but as soon as people had the opportunity and made a little money, got some reserves, they built a frame house, and the sod house would be relegated to a root cellar, a potato cellar, or something like that. But this really was the sod house frontier, this area of the Western Plains. The short grass prairie was perfect. They called it prairie marble. Mm. And they'd cut it out in slabs and build these dwellings.
Yeah, almost.
And let me tell you, they're small. You're talking 12 by 16 feet. You're talking families of, you know, 5, 6, 7 living in them. I remember one of the people who was interviewed, he said it was terrible because if company arrived, he had nowhere to change out of his work clothes. So this was bare living. Water was even tougher. I mean, water was the immediate need. You couldn't carry it in. You're unlikely to have a spring because the ranchers had already got those. The Ogallala Aquifer, the groundwater is under the ground there, but it's at varying depths. And so people would drill wells, and sometimes they'd hit water in 20, 30 feet. Sometimes they wouldn't hit it in 200 feet. This was a problem. And, of course, food was, too.
Yeah. What did they eat?
Well, they ate the dried beans they brought in and the cornmeal they brought in, and if they had been a bit more fortunate, they'd bring some dried pork in that would keep. But it was going to be 6 or 9 months before your vegetable garden produced or crops gave you some money to buy some food. If you had canned foods, you were a rich person indeed bringing in canned foods. After a while, by the 1890s, catalogs came in, Montgomery Ward, Sears, and you could order food through them. The big source of food that had been there for thousands of years, the bison, was gone.
No.
And if the bison had been there, their problem would have been solved as far as food went. But by 86, 87, there's none left. They've been hunted out. Their bones were still there, and the settlers collected the bones. They would be used as fertilizers, and they'd get a certain price by delivering them at railroad stations, and they used the dung, of course, for fuel, because fuel was a problem. So they used buffalo chips. So the bison were still sustaining people long after they were gone.
Oh, man. That's a really interesting story about the food. The social side of it, I want to talk about, too, but let's get Tim and from Madison on first. Tim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Oh, my mother was homesteaded in the Oklahoma Panhandle in Beaver, Oklahoma, when she was about 2 years old. Wow. My grandparents went and homesteaded in 1903, 1904 in Oklahoma.
They probably had it. Oh, I said, go ahead.
Oh, and yeah, my mother was actually a pioneer and homesteaded there. And my grandparents went down, and my grandmother's sister went, so the two families went down. Then the men left the women and children there on the land because they had to occupy it, while the men went back to Kansas City to get jobs where they'd get paid to support the homestead.
Oh.
Yeah, Tim, this was a common pattern, Tim. The women tended to spend much more time than the men, you know, on these isolated homesteads with only perhaps their children for company, because the men not only went back to Kansas and Nebraska to shuck corn, they went to the out to Greeley to dig potatoes, they worked on the railroads, and so really, there were different sort of circulation patterns of men and women. And like your grandparents or your ancestors, it was the women who tended to get left back on the homestead.
Yeah. And there was a...
Right.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. Oh, and interesting, yeah. The descendants of the two families who went down there, I'm one, they were from Peoria, Illinois, And the other one that went down with them, are also here in Madison today.
Oh, so they made it.
We all ended up here after a brief stint in Oklahoma.
The Eastwood Movement Frontier.
There we go. Thanks, Tim. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. That's a good story. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. What about your story? 1-800-642-1234. I hope you'll join in as we visit today with our guest, David Wishart, professor of geography at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln and author of the book we're discussing, The Last Days of the Rain Belt. Really great to have him along. Lance in Green Bay, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hey, how are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call.
I guess my question is, and I'm just looking kind of for a comment, is that, you know, after Native Americans supposedly sold their land, which really we know didn't happen, don't you kind of believe that the whites that got drawn out there kind of got their just desserts for driving off Native Americans and killing all the bison? Just like some comments off the air, thanks.
All right.
You know, as a whole, perhaps you're right. As individuals go, these were ordinary people just trying to live their lives. I should say the land was bought. It was bought for a pittance, and it was bought under duress. But that was the United States' as policy. They wanted to solve their conscience whilst at the same time opening up the land for Americans. So it was bought, but it was bought for a few cents an acre.
Yeah, that's too bad. We have several other callers online. Again, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And the men and the women, I guess from the interviews, I think you noted that they had a whole kind of different attitude or about that area.
Yeah, I think even today, men and women see the Western High Plains differently. You know, for men, now, for example, there's easy access to the outdoors, to hunting and fishing. For women, it's lonely. Women, however, in my study, what I found, women were the ones who built the society. It was women who arranged for school districts to be made. It was women who arranged for areas to be put aside for graveyards and enclosed. Women were the builders of the community.
Yeah. Roger in Hartford, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. My question was, wouldn't the Indians, by mirror of their existence, show the futility of people moving out into that area?
Absolutely. But, you know, unfortunately, nobody paid attention to Indians. They were not looked upon then as someone who could be learned from. And, yeah, these were bison hunters. They didn't practice farming. And so that would have been a lesson well taken, yeah. But it wasn't even considered.
Yeah, too bad.
Exactly.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Appreciate it. Listener called to ask about if you had a comment on the large migration from the Volga, the Germans. There were ethnic Germans living along the River Volga. They were recruited as immigrants to Russia in the 18th century, and they were actually allowed to maintain their culture, I believe, languages and traditions and so forth.
Yeah, and then conditions on the Volga and around the Black Sea deteriorated for them, and they came to the Rain Belt, not in huge numbers, but locally they'd come in groups and might dominate a local area. And let me tell you, they were recruited like CEOs because they were pre-adapted to a semi-arid grassland. And it was the Germans from Russia who brought in drought-resistant wheat, particularly a brand called Turkey Red Wheat, which became the dominant winter wheat. So, you know, the railroad companies wanted them in their land grants because they knew how to handle it.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, then their entire culture, the languages, the traditions, you know, the Lutheran, the churches, the Lutheran, the Reformed, the Catholics, and the Mennonites, many emigrated to that area.
That's right. And so they were a diverse group, as you've just suggested.
John in Mineral Point, let's go to you next. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Interesting topic. I read a book a while ago by James Michener called Centennial. And this would be Centennial, Colorado. And he touches on this very subject a little farther west, but...
Yeah.
And it's one of his epic books that goes from the dinosaur age up to the 1920s. But
yeah.
Spent a lot of time on the settlers coming in and the ranchers and the conflict and them selling this land as very fertile and farmable.
Yeah.
If anybody interested in it might want to read that.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Thank you, John. Appreciate your call. Yeah, I haven't. Gosh, it's been a long time since I last looked at that book.
Yeah, me too.
quite a while back. But he's right. He's absolutely right. There was also an economic depression to deal with, as if there weren't enough problems, that we had an economic depression.
That's true. It's awfully contemporary, actually. There was a bubble that burst, and it wasn't just in the plains. It wasn't just in the United States. It was a global depression, and I suppose you could argue that these poor people out in eastern Colorado, by virtue of not being able to raise any crops at all, were almost immune to this depression because they had nothing to sell. You know, they were burning corn. The prices for corn were so low, they were burning the corn cobs. So yeah, this compounded it for sure.
Yeah. We had Deb commented on Facebook, who said my grandfather, grandparents homesteaded in northeastern Colorado. Both my both came from the western slope of Colorado. Parts of the homestead were still there the last time we visited. My grandparents raised 7 children, my father being the oldest, in that small house on the plains. Mm-hmm. And they left during World War II when Grandpa went to work in Cheyenne for United Airlines when they were doing military work, and my grandparents later moved to California with United.
Well, it just shows you that some people managed to see this out. And in fact, you know, the people whose interviews I read, in a way, were not necessarily typical because they managed to stick it out because they were still in eastern Colorado. Well, whilst the majority failed, and their story's gone forever.
Yeah, it must have been fun to read through all those interviews.
It was exciting. It really was. It was a treasure trove. I came upon it by accident, just mooching around as you do if you're a historian or a historical geographer. And, you know, I found these red leather-bound volumes with onion skin paper and these handwritten interviews.
Well, wow, what a treasure trove! I'm so lucky that, and how they came to be done, is really interesting.
Yeah, this Civil Works Administration, it only lasted for 6 months. It was one of these New Deal programs. Congress eventually canceled it out because they claimed it was too expensive, and it was really a work provision program. And nowhere else did it take the form it did in eastern Colorado, where they paid volunteers to go out and interview these people. That was their, you know, work program. And so that much overused word, unique, I think fits here.
Yeah, absolutely. Jenny in Wisconsin Rapids, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just love this show, and I love history, and we traveled out to Colorado and Nebraska in 1990. We were trout fishing in Nebraska, and we saw a lot of the tourist sites and Saudis that were a tourist attraction. But when we went into Colorado, there was a little town called Wagon Mound, and because the rock at the entrance of the town looks like a covered wagon, there were actually Saudis there that people were living in, and we met some of these people. They had electricity in them.
Oh,
my goodness.
Sod homes with electricity.
Yes, and they were fixed up. I mean, I took pictures of it because, of course, I'd never been out in that area before. And in Nebraska, we were there 11 days camping, and we met Good Samaritans, the Good Sam group.
Yeah.
And they were elderly. They were all older people. And, boy, the stories they would tell about the settlements out there and their grandparents and what they went through, I loved it. The other thing was they said that the Indians helped them a lot, you know, brought mm-hmm. them fish, you know, brought whatever. They seemed to really get along in that community.
Mm, interesting. Comment?
No, just David? I think it's wonderful that you can do you're doing geographical research. You know, you're going through the region. I've never seen sod houses, renovated sod houses, up-to-date sod houses. But I suppose there's no reason. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is 1990, so whether those soddies are still there, but they were well-kept, and they were right on the road going into this little cafe, right into Wagon Mound. So if you look that up on the map and see where Wagon Mound is, it's pretty interesting.
I'll have to check that out, but let's face it, I mean, a sod house is going to be a lot more effective than a trailer out on the Western Plains.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Rain Belt, you know, how did the Dust Belt, the Dust Bowl of the 20th century got up, you know, really all the press? And here we have this Rain Belt. How does it relate to the Dust Bowl of the 20th century? There's sort of a geographic overlap there, isn't there?
Well, there is, because if you look at the last 100, 200 years on the plains, there's been a cycle of wet years and dry years. And the 90s were wet, of course the 30s were. The 90s had dust storms too, but not to the extent of the 30s, because so much of the land had been plowed up in the 1920s, exposing that soil to the wind. And the 1930s... made the Great Plains America's problem region. There was a film, famous film, The Plow That Broke the Plains. Of course, there was Grapes of Wrath. And so it tended to overshadow the experience of the 1890s.
I remember watching the Plow That Broke the Plains in a film class I took from Professor Fritz Albert. It is quite a film. It's really
Very dramatic, yeah.
Very dramatic. We have many more callers and we're about out of time. Here we've got a century later. Are there still impacts from that period that we can see in the Rain Belt today?
Things changed in the you've still got this cycle of dry years and wet years. There was a terrible drought at the beginning of this century in eastern Colorado, where again entire counties receive no measurable rain. So that doesn't change. As the historian Walter Prescott Webb said, the desert is the guest who came to dinner and never to leave. But there is a difference. From the 1930s on, there was support. There was federal government support.
Yeah.
That started in the 1930s, and it never really left. And so you bottom out, there's a safety net there. That wasn't there in the 1890s. The federal government put no aid whatsoever into the region.
Yeah. Well, you've tell a fascinating story, and I really appreciate, David, you taking time to be with us today. It really is a fascinating book, and much appreciate your conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and thanks for your callers, too, for
their
questions.
Great calls and questions. David Wishart is the author, and you can go online to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can see it there, his name. He's a professor of geography at University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and author of some books, editor of several books, but author of The Last Days of the Rain Belt. Joined us today from NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. Great to have him along. Those stories of human experience and natural phenomena like the weather are always really interesting, I think. And coming up after this short break, the weather guys will be with us to talk about the weather we're experiencing now and what we might get in the weeks to come. That's up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.